Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Evans cannot be here this morning. He suffered a herniated disc yesterday and is on his back in his chambers, but he will be participating by speakerphone. So if you hear questions that appear to emanate from the ectoplasm, it's actually just from chambers in Milwaukee. Our first case this morning is a state of Enoch against Tenor. Mr. Barnes.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Attorney Robert Barnes. I represent the appellants, the estate of Angela Enoch. This case involves a Rule 68 offer and the fee petition award ultimately given by the District Court. This case involved a substantial factual complexity and difficulty. It also involved legal novelty and complexity. After about a year of litigation, ultimately the parties settled pursuant to a Rule 68 offer made by the defendant. Though this court in Fletcher versus the City of Fort Wayne, I believe 162 F3rd 975, recommended that defendants do fee-inclusive Rule 68 offers, the defendant in this case chose not to. Instead, they separated it out and said they would award a certain amount for damages, approximately $635,000, and any awardable fees and costs, that to be left up to the federal judiciary if they could not reach a stipulated resolution. After no stipulated resolution was reached, the fee petition was filed by the plaintiffs. The defendants objected and suggested that approximately $220,000 would be the appropriate fee award and for cost. The plaintiffs sought a little more than $300,000 for fees and cost for over 1,000 hours of legal work performed by various attorneys and particularly the lead counsel in this case, who has more than a dozen years of trial litigation experience and difficult personal injury matters. The District Court issued an order ultimately granting $100,000 in fees and cost. The District Court did not separate out which cost it was approving and which cost it was not. The District Court did not dispute the hourly rate submitted by lead counsel or by appellant's counsel. The District Court did not dispute the hours employed, the necessity or reasonableness thereof. The District Court recognized that the litigation served an important public purpose, namely its deterrent effect on the state in the way it managed care and institutionalized care for severely mentally ill young women in the state of Wisconsin. The court also recognized and did not dispute that there were substantial legal issues in the case. Instead, the court determined, using the almost an eyeball test, similar to the kind this court has previously stated was not the proper methodology to be employed, that the fee should be reduced to $100,000 from the $300,000 requested for all fees and cost, because a part of the complaint that was filed sought damages potentially of $5 million for the estate and $5 million for some other plaintiffs in the case. The reliance upon the complaint was a mistaken basis for a fee determination under this court's precedent. The District Court cited this court's decision in Briggs. And Briggs was a nominal damages case where the plaintiffs went to trial, lost it, well, prevailed on the merits, but the damages they sought before the jury were not awarded. Instead, the jury only awarded $4 in damages. The court noted that under FAR-R, that fits under the nominal damages exception to a fully compensatory fee award. This court recognized in that limited circumstance. As this court has articulated in Zagorski versus Midwest Billing Services, and as every other circuit has articulated, including the Fourth Circuit, Sixth Circuit, Eighth Circuit, Ninth, and Tenth Circuits, the nominal damages limitation on a fully compensatory fee award for plaintiffs who win on the underlying merits is limited to just those cases. For example, the defendants in this case cite to this court the court's decision in Cole. In Cole, the plaintiffs sought recovered only about $1,500 to $2,500 in damages or thereabouts, and that was sufficient to be outside of
the... Save my wandering around. There was a relief granted beyond the money damage. What was there? Was there not?
There was an agreement for the amount of $635,000 in monetary damages plus any awardable fees and costs.
Is that all?
Yes, Your Honor. That was all in terms of what happened inside the courtroom. the court recognized that the nature of the case and the nature of the settlement had a deterrent effect on the state of Wisconsin outside the courtroom.
But there was no order entered pursuant to that theory.
No, Your Honor, because this was the estate in this case. Absolutely. No problem, Your Honor.
I have a question. When you receive a offer of judgment like this, I assume you go back to the defendants and say, you know, if you want to jack that offer up a couple $100,000 and include attorney's fees, then we'd accept it. And you have those kind of give-and-take negotiations. Did that actually go on here?
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor. The record is limited because certain Wisconsin has a plaintiff's version of Rule 68, and there was some question about whether the Wisconsin state statute application of its version of Rule 68 could apply. It did not because it was not a diversity case. However, the state of California also has it where plaintiffs are allowed to submit it. And it was the plaintiff's position that a fee-inclusive Rule 68 offer should be made. This court recommended that same protocol in Fletcher versus the city of Fort Wayne, which I believe is cited at 162 F3rd 975, in which the court recommended that that's the appropriate manner to do a Rule 68 offer for a defendant rather than create the complexities and also the litigation that occurs from doing a fee-exclusive offer.
That's what happened here. To try to resolve the case, we end up with just as much litigation over attorney's fees.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor, that is why it was
practical way to resolve the case, but...
Absolutely, Your Honor. The court's encouraged position of a fee-inclusive offer is the one the plaintiffs urged. The unfortunate effect of the district court's order is that it will discourage fee-inclusive offers in the future because defendants will know, well, maybe I'll get a two-thirds fee reduction. Maybe I'll get an 80% fee reduction. Neither side, the plaintiffs won't know whether accepting that Rule 68 offer will allow them to recover most of their fees. In this case, almost more than 70% of the fees and costs were taken away from the plaintiffs, and it changed the nature of what they accepted and thought they'd accepted. So it unduly influences the settlement process, and it encourages the wrong approach for defendants to take in these kind of cases. Instead, the assumed at the time they accepted the fee award or the Rule 68 offer, they assumed all reasonable hours would be awarded, and it was only a matter of whether should they have done 19 hours on this matter or 17 hours, should the rate be $275 an hour or $250. They assumed it would be a small amount of discrepancy, and that's in fact reflected in the underlying trial court pleadings where the plaintiffs are seeking a little more than $300,000. The defendants are saying they think $220,000 is reasonable. So to suddenly out of that come $100,000, which is far less than anybody was talking about, was a major shock.
Hey, can you answer one other question for me? It seemed like the magistrate was the one who did most of the work in this case and got the two sides at least together. Was there any reason why the magistrate didn't get involved in this decision and why Judge Randa did?
That is unclear, Your Honor. It appears that Judge Randa decided to issue this opinion himself. I believe he issued it around Election Day. I'm not sure what happened or why it happened that the magistrate was not involved. But Your Honor's point is well taken. Indeed, the district court did not see much of the litigation here. Most of the issues were outside the court or before the magistrate. The defendant in this case had taken a $0, $0, $0 position up until the magistrate sat down and did mediation, and then they changed their position. If an evidentiary hearing had been held as to this settlement history and the confidences and privileges had been waived about that, then the plaintiffs would have been very happy with that because they would have shown that the settlement outcome here was very close to what they were seeking. So
the magistrate had the case only on a referral, not on consent, obviously.
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
But I would just think that in a case like this that the parties would consent and have the magistrate decide everything. He's the one who seemed to have most of the involvement in this case.
Oh, and I believe if the magistrate had been involved in the fee process, we wouldn't be here now.
Yeah, I agree.
The state relies on the position. They admit that this is not a nominal damages case. even though Briggs was a nominal damages case and the district court relied upon it, and Briggs went out of its way to say over and over again, this is only applicable to nominal damages cases. The state asserts and recognizes in their reply brief, or their opposition brief, rather, that this is not a nominal damages case, that this court has previously recognized a $275,000 award to be substantial. Clearly, a $635,000 award is substantial. Instead, they argue that the parties are partially prevailing. But as the Supreme Court made clear in Hensley and this court made clear in Leonard v. Argento, the relevant standard for partially prevailing is when you seek claims that are factually unrelated and dissimilar. And here, all of the legal claims brought were based on the exact same core set of facts and the same core theories.
Where did the $10 million figure enter the case?
All it did is in the complaint, Your Honor. What it was is...
Why is there any amount in the complaint?
Usually, Your Honor, that's done because plaintiff's attorneys... It's to discourage default. That's all. That's why traditionally...
I don't understand.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's neither necessary to plead money in federal court nor appropriate because it doesn't have anything to do with the nature of the claim.
And subsequently, I'm sure plaintiff's attorneys are not going to be putting any amount in the damages amount. It was
usually we see damages amounts in order to get notice in the press, which is a form of fraud on people who don't know the legal system. It just doesn't seem to have anything to do with the case, so it's odd to put it in, and then odd for the district court to say, well, you pleaded some spectacular number, so the actual recovery must be peanuts.
Yes, it is odd all the way across the board, Your Honor. The traditional protocol back a ways for younger plaintiff's attorneys who came up before was through the state court system was that if you put a certain amount in there, a big amount, it put them on notice and so the defendant wouldn't default. Now, that's typically for smaller cases. It doesn't become a major factor in bigger cases. And as the court notes, ultimately the court determines its own amount in a default judgment case under the current existing law. So it's no longer necessary. It was simply a mistaken apprehension.
No longer necessary. That particular rule was changed in 1938.
In the federal
system. It hasn't been necessary during the lifetime of the lawyers.
For the federal court system, that is correct, Your Honor. However, that one fact should not have been the dispositive or determinative fact for the court's fee award, Your Honor. The fee award should have been based on whether there was substantial public benefit. The court recognized there was. The district court recognized there was. Whether or not there was a public purpose served and whether there were substantial legal issues implicated, the district court recognized there was. And whether from a retrospective...
You're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Well, then I'll preserve the rest of my time for my rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Ms. Burkert-Brist.
Good morning. May it please the court, good morning. I'm Assistant Attorney General Monica Burkert-Brist from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the defendants, appellees, employees of the state of Wisconsin. We are here today on a matter which a former Chief Justice Berger, in his concurrence in Hensley, referred to as one of the least socially productive types of litigation imaginable, appeals from awards of attorney's fees.
Let me ask you a question, taking off on what the Chief Judge Easterbrook just asked. It seems to me that Judge Randa put an awful lot of weight on this $10 million demand, emphasizing that the recovery was only 12% of that. If the demand had been left blank, or let's say it was $1,000 or $1 million demand, using the system that Judge Randa seemed to use, the attorney's fees would have been a lot larger here, wouldn't it?
Judge, there are two things I'd like to say in response to that issue about Judge Randa. First of all, there's been a misperception created here as to his alleged lack of knowledge or intimacy with the details of this case at the district court level.
I never said he lacked knowledge of the case.
No, I didn't mean to imply.
The magistrate had been, looked like the magistrate was deeply involved in the case that ended up getting a Rule 68 offer out of the defendant.
Right, Judge, and I didn't mean to imply that you had implied that. I do believe, however, that appellant's counsel did. And what I wanted to say in that regard is that the magistrate in this case was only involved for the purposes of attempting to mediate a settlement. And there's no question that he was intimately involved in that portion of this process. However, the record before the trial court establishes clearly that there were many litigated pretrial matters in this case, which Judge Randa handled directly and issued numerous orders on. So I think it's unfair for appellant's counsel to lead this court to believe that the judge who issued the award.
To the question that Judge Evans actually asked.
Yes.
Which is, why should it make a difference to attorney's fees whether the complaint demanded $10 million or $500,000? District Court's approach seems to say that if a complaint demands $10 million, the attorney's fees will be slashed. And if the complaint demanded $500,000, the plaintiff's lawyer should get a bonus for superlative performance. But talk is cheap, so what you put in the complaint shouldn't matter, one would think.
Well, I don't think that what you put in the complaint should not matter at all. I think what happened in this case, as noted in the record.
Well, if you don't have to put anything in, why would it make
any difference? Correct. Well, the reason I think it made a difference in this case is because of the facially deficient fee petition that was presented by the plaintiffs below. What happened here is that the court had virtually nothing to work with from plaintiffs' counsel. I'm sorry?
You lost me altogether. If it doesn't make any difference, why consider it at all?
Right. If the fee petition was deficient, then the judge should just deny it because of those deficiencies. But that's not what the district judge did. The district judge denied it because the recovery was small in relation to the amount demanded in the complaint. Well, he didn't deny it, but he slashed it down. So let's deal with what the district court's actual reasons were.
What the district court did was, in my opinion, is it applied the Hensley framework. It cited the Hensley framework. It relied on the Hensley framework. It relied on both Hensley and Farrar, I believe, for two reasons. One is because you had a prevailing party in the case of the estate, but you had nominal parties in the case of the other plaintiffs in the case. So I think the court appropriately referenced both standards. I think the limited success and the emphasis placed on damages awarded versus damages sought, as set forth in the Hensley framework, is completely appropriate in a case whereas here the only potential outcome was a monetary damages award at the end of the case. So it would be the state's position that, in fact, the court did apply the appropriate framework given what it was faced with in terms of the submissions of the counsel below. It is our position that the matter before you presents no novel legal issue nor any abuse of discretion by the district court that would warrant a reversal of the fee award in this case. I believe there are three reasons primarily why the district court decision should be upheld. First and most importantly, the court was right. The reasoning was sound. It applied the factors set forth in Hensley, and it made reductions based upon those specific factors. Second, the court should uphold the decision to send a message that counsel who filed deficient fee petitions do so at their own peril. It would place on the district court the burden for fixing counsel's mistakes if the court were expected to hold evidentiary hearings.
The insufficient fee request. As I understand, there's not a real dispute here as to the hours to this Lodestar amount, is there?
Well, Judge, I actually think the only Lodestar amount that really appears in the record is the amount that the defendants suggested by after going through the Lodestar analysis and then suggesting a decrease in the amount of fees for times expended and duplicative billing. The plaintiff appellant below placed no Lodestar amount really before the court other than just the affidavit indicating the amount of time expended and the rate charged. The defendants, when we defended against that below, did suggest reductions which would have created a Lodestar of approximately $230,317. It would be that Lodestar that I believe is actually the only real Lodestar in the record unless we take at face value the petition from the plaintiff. Did that answer your question, Judge?
I suppose so.
Thirdly, the district court's award in the case should be upheld because it was consistent with the contractual agreement reached among the parties in this case through the Rule 68 offer of judgment process. By the very terms of the accepted Rule 68 offer, the appellants agreed to accept awardable costs and fees as may be determined by the district court. Not all costs and fees, but awardable costs and fees as they may be appropriate under Section 1988. to overturn the decision at this point would basically absolve the appellants of their obligation to accept the outcome of the bargain they struck in that Rule 68 process.
Supposing the judge had entered a $1,000 award, would they still be in a position where they wouldn't be able to beef about it?
No, I don't think they waived their appeal rights, and I do not mean to imply that they did.
Well,
what I'm indicating is that I believe that the Rule 68 process does create an obligation on the parties, and I do believe that...
Didn't you say that they had the duty to accept the judicial decision?
No. What I was suggesting was that if we simply remand at this point and allow a complete new fee award petition, that what you've done is absolve them from having to show the type of responsibility that was required at the first stage of the fee petition process, which was to provide the court with an appropriate fee petition to begin with. I think if what we allow people to do is if they file a deficient fee petition, that results in a lower award and they use the appeals...
The whole thing is an inadequate plea petition... by the plaintiff, you say.
I'm sorry?
The whole thing is the inadequacy of the petition of the plaintiff.
I think that greatly contributed to the outcome that you see in this district court decision, yes, because I think the judge had very little to work with. What the judge had was initial pleadings.
You told me you knew everything about it.
Pardon me?
You told me he knew everything about it. He'd worked with it fully.
He had worked.
What did he have to... What more did he need?
Well, what he should have had
tears,
was...
Tears? Sobs?
What he should have had was an appropriate affidavit which indicated the appropriate market rates, a brief from counsel which indicated
what... Was there a dispute as to whether the market rate was? I thought that was agreed. Everybody agreed that the market rate...
The defendants only disputed the market rate as to one attorney who was not admitted to practice in Wisconsin at the time he was submitting his fees.
Other than that, they paid no attention to it.
No. We specifically addressed it.
Oh.
We challenged the reasonability of the hours expended. We challenged on a number of grounds. We challenged the reasonability of the hours expended. We challenged certain duplicative billings. We challenged certain block billings. We challenged certain costs that we felt were excessive or not awardable under the statute. And we challenged the garden ad litem fees, which, as you see, is also treated extensively in the district court's opinion. But what I mean when I say that the district court had very little to work with is that the district court was the sitting court that handled all the pretrial litigation in this case. And there were multiple motions which the court decided on briefs and affidavits of counsel prior to the case being resolved. That's what I meant when I said that the district court itself was very familiar with the case. The court had been actively involved in the case. But when it came to the time of the fee petition, the court had relatively little in front of it from the plaintiff's counsel to support that fee petition. And in fact, the defendants were in the position of having to argue for the first time in their defense brief and submissions the lodestar and whether the appropriate reductions should be made. The state does not believe that this case presents any radical departure from existing precedent in a fee award case. While it is true that the $10 million figure that the court references comes from the initial complaint in this case, there was no other evidence presented before the court for the court to rely on in order to determine what an appropriate degree of success in this case would be. The best analogy that I can come up with would be if this case had been actually tried to a jury, and at the end of the day, in the damages phase of the case, the jury had rejected a proposal from the plaintiff for $10 million in damages and instead awarded $635,000, an amount specifically proposed by the defense in the damages phase of the trial. Because that is, in essence, what ended up occurring in this case. What ended up occurring in this case is that the plaintiffs made a voluntary strategic choice to accept a damage award that the defendants offered to them via the Rule 68 process. That means that the trier of fact in such a situation has very little to work with, unlike a jury verdict after a full trial. That strategic decision was a voluntary decision by them to accept a status as a partially prevailing plaintiff in this case. And on that basis, I think the court's reasoning was sound and the decision should be upheld. We have a very high deference standard here that we're looking at on appeal of a district court's award of fees. At the very most, I would say that if a remand were necessary in this case, it should be remanded solely for the issue of asking Judge Randa to explain his lodestar analysis and his basis for the reduction further so that this court would avoid having to look at it again on review. But in that situation, I would strongly urge that a remand, if any, only occur with very, very, very clear instructions to the court on a very limited review so that we don't continue to take an already over-litigated case and have it result in further litigation on fees that would be unnecessary. In conclusion, the state would respectfully suggest that the district court was, if anything, generous to the appellants given the deficient fee petition with which it was presented and the outrageously high fee demanded. This was a fee demand for over $320,000 during the pretrial stages of a civil rights case that never even made it through the summary judgment briefing process. This was not a case that was fully litigated to a jury. This was a case that lasted approximately a year and in which fees exceeded, the fee request exceeded over $300,000.
You have to correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me $635,000 award in a case like this is pretty high.
Well, go ahead.
There are all that many cases in the district court in Wisconsin where awards exceed that. So, I mean, this is a big case, dollar-wise. Don't you agree?
Well, Judge, there's no question that a $635,000 award is a very substantial award. This was a case in which a young woman died while incarcerated at the Tichita Correctional Institution from a self-strangulation attempt. So there's no question that the issues...
It wasn't an attempt. It was
a successful attempt. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And there's no question, however, that in this type of a case, when the sole remedy available are monetary damages, that the Hensley standard, as carried out by this circuit in numerous cases, is that the measure of the damages ultimately awarded is appropriate against those demanded. And in this procedural posture, the only numerical measures available to the district court was the demand of the plaintiffs in their original complaint, which they chose to put in the complaint, as has been noted here by this court, versus the offer that they then voluntarily accepted that was tendered by the defendants. And on those facts, we would submit that that there is no basis to overturn the award because the judge followed the appropriate Hensley factors, and the high level of deference normally accorded that type of a decision would be appropriate in this case. When all of these factors are taken into account, it's clear that the court should afford this district court decision the high-level deference that it actually deserves. If ever there were a case in which the trial court, which had to endure the underlying antics of counsel in this case, was best equipped to judge the appropriateness of the pretrial work, it is this case. And we would request that on that basis the district court's award be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Barnes?
Just 3 points for the court. First, the appropriate standard for a determination of law, there's not meaningfully facts in dispute on appeal, is not an abuse. The abuse of discretion, there is an abuse of discretion when the district court misapplies the law to a particular set of facts, and that's what took place here. Secondly, as to the adequacy of the fee petition detailed all the billings, all the hours, the hourly rate. What the defendant invites is even more massive litigation with fee petitions. To go into even more detail about here's what somebody else charged in this case, that case, another case, it would take fee litigation into a whole new realm to go beyond the basic nature of a fee petition, which is here's my hourly rate, here's why it's reasonable, here's my hours, here's my billing statements and cost invoices attached. That's what happened here. That is sufficient. And if the district court had any problem with it, he could have so documented. The district court did not take issue with the adequacy of the fee petition in that sense. Third, as to what the Rule 68 offer nature, what the defendant invites is to make Rule 68 very difficult for all plaintiffs, because the defendant says that the plaintiff should essentially take whatever the district court is going to grant without regard to what that may be. And if they subject themselves to that, they're often not going to take Rule 68 offers, and then there's going to be all kinds of complexity after trial about what the Rule 68 meant or didn't mean previously, because that part of goes into an analysis as to whether Rule 68 foreclosed certain costs and fees from being recovered. So in order to preserve and protect Rule 68, preserve and protect the meaning of the civil rights statute, and to preserve and protect good plaintiff's policy, to discourage what the court recognizes, plaintiffs, instead of aiming high, will just aim really, really low. So they can come in and say, look, we went above our point. We asked for $50,000. We got $350,000. So remove that altogether, and the best way to do so is to follow the same analysis this court has always recommended and always advised, which is for defendants to do fee-inclusive petitions, but where they're not, that the fees that should be awarded are the reasonable fees based on the lodestar analysis that the district court did not employ here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.